We finally got a good game in the college football playoffs, but it wasn't the one that we suspected. What did we learn about Texas and Arizona State? And can anyone beat Ohio State? All that plus so much more on today's edition of the College Football Power Hour. Welcome in to the College Football Power Hour. He's Adam Brenneman. That is Jason Fitz. And I am Caroline Fenton. Welcome. And we're reacting to two more games to the College Football Playoff quarterfinal. We had Texas, Arizona State, and Ohio State, Oregon yesterday. Now, Sugar Bowl has been postponed following the terror attacks on New Year's Eve night in New Orleans. So all of our thoughts and all of our prayers are with everyone in New Orleans and all of those that were affected by the heinous acts that we saw earlier this week. But the Sugar Bowl will take place on Thursday. We'll have a full reaction to that game on tomorrow's edition of the podcast. Texas and Arizona State, and finally, Fitz, we got a good game in the college football playoff. And I was saying all week long, it's going to be Ohio State, Oregon. That's going to be the most close contested game. We'll get into that game because that just kind of fell in line with the rest of the trend of the college football playoff. But Texas wins it 39-31 in two overtimes. Fitz, were you surprised by the showing that we saw from Arizona State and how close that game was?
Yeah, I mean, look, to be honest, I predicted a blowout here. We all know that. I go back to something Brenneman said a month and a half ago about Arizona State. The size on the defensive line is something that we needed to take into account. I think it showed up in that game. And y'all, like, let's be clear. The college football playoff needed this, and they needed it from this game. More so than Oregon, Ohio State. Like, they needed one of the teams that people are trying to pile on that want to say they didn't belong or they didn't get the right seed or all of that. They needed one of those teams to come out and show that there's a reason this process is what it is. Now, we can argue about seeding, we can argue about ranking and all of that. We will, I'm sure, all the way until next year's college football playoff. But for Arizona State to come back in this game, for Arizona State to play as tough, for Arizona State to out-physical their opponent for a lot of this football game, I think that was a really important, Adam, part of what we had to see from the college football playoff. Just to shut all the haters up, we needed that game to be what it turned out to be.
Yeah, it might have been one of the games of the year in college football. And the way ASU came back, honestly, guys, I turned the game off at one point. Right? I mean, it looked like it was over. It looked like the game was absolutely over. And then 5 minutes later, I turned it back on, and ASU's back in the game after the Cam Scataboo passing touchdown. I mean, it was unbelievable how Arizona State rallied back in that one. And I'll get into the kind of X's and O's schemes in a second. But I think big picture-wise, it's clear that the teams who had a month off between games and had a bye all started slow. The rust piece definitely played a factor in these games. Boise State started slow against Penn State. Arizona State got off to a terrible start. Oregon looked awful after having 4 weeks off. So that definitely is a factor in these things. And I think everyone probably agrees that the seeding piece in the college football playoff needs to be fixed next year. There's no reason Oregon should be playing Ohio State in their first game when Penn State gets SMU and Boise. But having that time off, I think, is almost too much time off for some of these teams, and it's going to end up playing a factor, and coaches are going to start to change how they view the rest versus rust factor. I was concerned with what attendance was going to look like at some of these games, given that these are quarterfinals, final games. There's still two more games possibly for fans to travel to. That was a non-factor. I mean, the crowds for the second round games were fantastic. Places were electric. It was cool. I mean, the Texas Arizona State crowd was unreal, especially at the end of that game. The ASU fans came out in droves, so it was really, really cool to see. And I think, to your point, Fitz, college football needed this to happen with Arizona State, Texas. There's only been one game now decided by one score in this entire thing so far. This is the only one. Arizona State, Texas. And this, it's clear, this is not the NFL. There is far more variance in college football. NFL has a salary cap. NFL has detailed rules around roster construction built exactly for one score games in the playoffs. College football doesn't have that. And competitive balance is not quite where it needs to be in college football. So it was really good to see Arizona State come back, because I feel like it gave everyone some hope that college football and expanding the playoff was the right thing to do. Now, there's still obviously some things to figure out, but it was big for just the sport of college football in general.
I'll again throw myself under the bus real quick here, Caroline. I was hosting a show on Fox Sports Radio yesterday, and when we started, the game was out of control. And so as I started the show, I was like, yeah, another blowout in the college football playoff. It's fine. We'll get through it. We'll get to Oregon, Ohio State. By the time we finished the show, as we were leaving air, I'm like, we're headed went to overtime. Like, it's amazing how 2 hours just changed literally everything in the way we were talking about the playoff, the way we viewed this, the way we view Texas. Like, it, I mean, this thing, when it, early on, when it's 17-3, you're like, yep, even though Texas isn't doing the things they need to do, they're so much better. They're going to be just fine. And then all of a sudden you realize, no, there is one rule. I don't care. To Adam's point, the NFL is different than college football. I don't care if we're talking about Pop Warner, like Pee Wee. I don't care how, where you go. If you let an opponent hang around, eventually it bites you in the butt. And I mean, there was this moment where Arizona State just kept hanging around and he thought, man, I don't know. Texas couldn't find the foot on the gas on their offense. It just looked out of sync. So I'll throw myself, Caroline, under the bus. I started a show talking about a slaughter and ended the show talking about overtime.
We all did. Like, we're all guilty of it, Fitz. I said, I was like, surely we're going to get a good game at some point in the college football playoffs. Here's just yet another blowout. But it did kind of feel like at some point that Texas was playing with just a little bit too much fire. And I don't mean like playing with passion. I mean playing a little bit too close to the fire, because Texas largely was carried in the first half, and all at the first three quarters was largely carried by special teams points. They had the Silas Bolden punt return for a touchdown, and then several field goals, and then Arizona State was dominating time of possession. Like, we all got to the point where we were just like not sitting on our couches, dialed in. We were all just kind of running around doing other things, myself included. And it felt like every single time I was watching the game, this was before Arizona State's comeback in the fourth quarter, Arizona State had the football. It was because Texas was scoring so quickly. I mean, at some point in the game, I believe it was the first quarter, Texas ran three plays and had 14 points. Like, it was just, it just felt like at some point that had to come back to bite Texas in the butt. And eventually it did. Cam Scadaboo leaves the game. He's yakking on the sidelines. He comes back in. He has the touchdown pass you talked about, Adam. And then he has the rushing touchdown. And all of a sudden it felt like all of this momentum had just shifted in Arizona State's favor. They were getting some of the favorable calls, except the targeting call. I'll ask you guys about that. Adam, I'll ask you. Targeting? Fair foul? Should it have been called targeting? Could that have been the call that handed Arizona State their ticket to the college football playoff semifinal?
Yeah, the no targeting call was a ludicrous call by the referees. And we have to talk about the rules and consistency on these targeting calls. The no call there was absurd. On a game-winning drive, and by all the textbook definitions of targeting, and it's something that as a broadcaster who calls games, they make us study the two different types of targeting and defenseless receiver versus not. Because I have to predict when I'm calling a game before the before they make the call, they want the announcers to give my opinion on what it should be, right? So, I mean, we study that a lot. And I'm telling you, I spent a lot of time trying to figure it out, and I can't figure out what the actual rules are for targeting. I'm all for not letting the refs control the game. I don't want refs to control the game. But that was a textbook, very obvious targeting call. And listen,
But it wasn't. This is the problem with the rule, Adam. Like, because I'm with you. It's a tough rule. We did the college football playoff seminar when I was at ESPN. We watched targeting. And then they quizzed the whole room. They would show a play and say, was it targeting? We had to figure it out. And the whole room got it wrong over and over and over again. But if you look, like, I've got the rules in front of me. And the one thing I'd say is that the rule in front of me, as written, requires a launch. There was no launch. A crouch followed by an upward and forward thrust to attack with forcible contact at the head. There was no crouch. It required leading with the helmet, shoulder, forearm, fist, hand, or elbow to attack with forcible contact at the head or neck area. It was a face mask to face mask hit. It requires lowering the head before attacking, initiating forcible contact. He didn't lower the head. I think if you slow it down and you break down those rules that the review group is looking at, it didn't have any of those things. It looks like targeting because we see a face to a face. But if you look at the rules, it's not targeting.
But there's two different types of targeting. The one you're just talking about is the launching with the head or neck area with the crown of your helmet. There's also a targeting for defenseless receiver, which doesn't need to be in that factor. It doesn't matter what the defender used. As if there's contact to the head or neck area of a defenseless receiver, that's forcible contact. That is targeting. It doesn't matter it doesn't matter. There still needs to be a launch, but it doesn't need to be it doesn't need to be the head or helmet of the defender. It just needs to be contact to the head or helmet of the defenseless player. It doesn't matter what the defender uses.
Defenseless player note 2 says a receiver attempting to catch a forward pass or in position to receive a backward pass, or one who has completed a catch and has not had time to protect themselves and has not clearly become a ball carrier. So the question is, did he have time to protect himself? Was he actually defenseless in that moment? Like, I don't know that. I don't think it's that clear cut. Like, again, I'm being the rules weenie because I got the rule in front of me. But like, I think when you just break that, this is a problem with targeting, to Adam's point, is that it looks like targeting, but if I'm just going to sit here and say, well, here's the rule, I don't know that I can say definitively it was.
And I think Kenny Dillingham said it perfectly after the game, that he was asked about this in his post-game press conference, and he said, I can't comment on a ruling where I simply don't understand what the rule is, or something like that. That was his answer. And I think that's the frustrating part, to your point, Fitz. But Adam, one more quick thing,
because I think you're right about all of this. College football could fix this if they would simply take what the XFL did and they would mic up the review room. Like, when the XFL had any time there was a review, Dean Blandino was mic'd up, and you actually heard Dean Blandino explain the call that he was making. And I didn't always agree with him when I was covering the XFL, but I at least understood where he was coming from. I wish to God we had had last night on this game, I wish we had had the room mic'd up so that we could hear the why that they didn't call it targeting. I think it would answer some of these questions, and then Dillingham could have some sort of reasoning behind it. Without that, we're all just sitting here grasping at straws.
But now, my final thoughts are the television broadcast, Jesse Palmer calling the game as the analyst, and the rules analyst came on during the review and both said, this is targeting. The rules expert, former referee, former replay official, I forget what his name was, said it should be targeting, then was called no targeting. I think the important factor here, and I hate to be a conspiracy theorist, but let's just be honest, the money for Texas to be in Dallas was too strong for that game to end in an Arizona State walk-off targeting call and for Arizona State to win the game.
I mean, you really think that a person that, like, their whole livelihood comes on the replay official portion of it is sitting here with either somebody in his ear or thinking this is what I have to do?
I'm not saying anybody is in their ear. I'm saying that referees are human beings. They're all humans. And that call, that targeting call right there, is a ref deciding the game, and Arizona State would have won that game with targeting call. It's a 15-yard penalty. And Arizona State would have been in field goal range to win the game at that moment. I'm saying that with that refs understand what's happening, and that call ends that game essentially. Still got to make a field goal, but I think that
which is no easy task for that team.
Clearly,
the guy made two under 40 yarders. The Arizona State kicker did in that game. I mean, I think that Texas losing that game on a targeting call would have been a big call to make for an official. That's what I'm saying.
But this is where officials are damned if they do and damned if they don't. If they make the call, then we sit here and we say, oh my God, why are officials ending games? Like, we sit here and say we don't want officials to be the ones that decide a football game. And then when an official doesn't make a call, now the official is the one that decided the football game. Like, I don't know what refs are supposed to do. I'm a referee sympathist at this point, if that's a phrase. I sympathize for referees at this point because I sit here and say, I don't know what you're supposed to do. You make a call and all of a sudden it's, oh, how can you make a call in that moment? You don't make a call and it's, how could you not make the call in that moment? I don't think it's as clear cut. So I get that the official expert on the broadcast and Jesse called it one way. I'll go back to sitting in a room with a bunch of us all watching the same thing. And we all know this. Like, you ask 20 people, it's the same thing with what's a catch in the NFL. We sit here every time and we hold our breath because we don't really know what a catch is in the NFL. This is that. I think, to me, the concept that somebody is influenced by the brand on this just doesn't, that doesn't feel accurate to the people that I've ever worked around in college football.
I would agree with you. And I am also one of those people that says, I don't want a game, especially a college football playoff game, to end or be decided by the referees. I think back to the Super Bowl a couple of years ago, Chiefs and Eagles. That game was essentially ended by a hold, a ticky-tack hold. And I was very against that. And everybody on the other side said, if you see it, you have to call it. And I said, yes, but it was a very ticky-tack hold, and it essentially ended the Super Bowl. I'm very pro, if you see it, you have to call it. But also, if it's splitting of hairs, let it go. Just let it go. It's the final few minutes. It's the final few seconds of the game. Just let it go. That targeting was so egregious yesterday. It was so textbook targeting kind of hits that you want to take out of the game, that to not call it, I think, is like just crazy to me because it was so obvious. It was so egregious. It wasn't just like a, eh, do we call it? Do we don't? It's ticky tack if we don't. No, it was so obvious and it was so egregious. And we can open up the rule book and dissect every single little bullet point. But at the end of the day, what is the essence of the rule of targeting? Is to eliminate head-to-head contact, is to eliminate the injuries that head-to-head contact causes. So that is exactly what we got, was crown of the helmet to crown of the helmet. When a receiver had just gotten the football and barely even took a step, Michael Taft was in his face. So I was frankly floored that targeting was not called on that play. But then after that was the ultimate ball don't lie moment. Bert Auburn misses the field goal. They take it to overtime. And so, you know, Fitz, you say that you are a ref sympathizer. I have a hard time being an Arizona State sympathizer not getting that call, because if you stop a touchdown pass on 4th and 13, we're probably not talking about any of this, because Arizona State's defense for 3 downs played great football in overtime. 4th and 13, Quinn Ewers isn't touched, and he throws a beautiful football right in the hands of Matthew Golden, who was essentially untouched. Everybody in the stadium, everyone watching at home, knew exactly where Quinn Ewers wanted to throw the football. Everyone knew it was going to Matthew Golden. That's where he was going all day long. So you make a stop on 4th and 13, 4th and forever. We could be talking about in Arizona State, Ohio State matchup in the college football playoff semifinal.
Agreed. And I think my last comment on the targeting call is and Fitz, to clarify my point about the Texas going to Dallas point. My opinion, and this may not be accurate, and you can disagree, is that if the roles are reversed, Texas gets that targeting call. And Texas is getting a 15-yard penalty, and that the brand plays some kind of factor in this. That's my opinion. And I think the call was wrong, and I think Arizona State should have gotten it. Now, ball doesn't lie. They missed the kick, goes overtime, and Arizona State had a chance to win the game with a 4th and 13. My thoughts on the game are, one, we knew Arizona State was going to fight, and they did exactly that. That's what Kenny Dillingham has done all year. I mean, they were down 16 in the fourth quarter. And I think it's easy to look at what Caroline just said, the 4th and 13 in overtime, and view that as how Arizona State lost. But, I mean, listen, if Cam Scadabu doesn't throw a 50-yard touchdown on 4th and 3 on a toss pass, they would have lost by 3 scores. So
that was
hats off
awesome,
to Kenny Dillingham for leaving nothing in the tank. Yeah, he left nothing in the tank. I think my other thought after watching that game is that Sam Levitt's a top 5 quarterback in college football going into next season. That 3rd down and 14 pickup he had with his legs in overtime, very few quarterbacks in college football can make that play. And it's going to be dangerous to see how good he can be with 14 games of tape and Kenny Dillingham and Marcus Arroyo there all winter getting that offense to click fully. For Texas, that simply was not good enough in the fourth quarter. Inexcusable, really, is the only way to put it. But they're still going to the semifinals, and they're still talented enough to win. I think, you know, Texas is a 5-point dog to Ohio State. And I think honestly, they maybe needed that close call against ASU. If Texas doesn't figure out how to run the ball against Ohio State, they're going to get housed. They'll get run off the field by Ohio State. Just ask Oregon, who ran for negative 23 yards and was down 34-0 to Ohio State. If Texas can't run the ball, which they couldn't do against an Arizona State D-line that has struggled against the run, they will get dominated and run off the field by Ohio State. So 53 total rushing yards for Texas in that game, not good enough. Wisner, I think, was like 2 yards a carry, 3 yards a carry. Longest run was 7 yards. Everyone else in the backfield was a non-factor for Texas. They got to figure out how to run the football, get the ball on the perimeter, but be able to run in between the tackles as well.
Yeah, and this is the second time in 3 games we've seen them not be able to run the football. Adam, you're 1,000% right about that. The concerning part here is that we all know that Texas has to run the football to win. They had to know that coming into this game, and they simply couldn't do it. And I look at it now and think, man, if Texas can't get this running game right, and they didn't against Georgia, they're not going to face any defenses now that are easier than the one they just faced. Like, if I got to give them benefit of the doubt moving forward to be able to run the football, well, they're about to play a tougher defense, whether it'll be Georgia, Notre Dame, or Ohio State the rest of the way through. All of those are going to be brutal matchups for them to try and run the football. And so I'm looking at it and saying, if we want trust, how the hell am I supposed to trust that Texas can actually run the ball? And look, Arizona State's going to spend the next several months saying what might have been. I mean, because we mentioned the 4th and 13, but also the punt return for a touchdown, the missed field goals. Like, Arizona State had every opportunity to win this football game behind a running back that had an otherworldly second half that I thought was really, to Adam's point, really schemed up well. And a quarterback that I was watching the whole time thinking, my guy's flying up draft boards. Just a game like this against Tech, he is flying up draft boards, right? Like, you just look at that and think, man, everything lined up really well in the last quarter and a half for Arizona State to get a win. And Texas has got to be looking in the mirror saying, I don't know how the hell we almost let that game get away.
Because they can't run the football. That's how. And Texas is a completely different team when they can versus when they can't run the football. We all see that. We've been talking about that for the last 2 months, about how different of a team Texas is when they can run the football. You don't think Ohio State sees that? You don't think that's going to be defensive game plan number one is to take Jaden Blue and Trey Wisner out of the football game and make Quinn Ewers beat you with his arm? Quinn Ewers can beat you with his arm, but I will take those odds with, 55 rushing yards for Texas like we saw yesterday against Arizona State. Like, I will take those odds and make Quinn Ewers beat me, because even yesterday and so many big-time games and even just games on Texas's schedule, Quinn Ewers is going to make a mistake. It's almost like a checkbox. It's almost like a bingo card every time we see Texas play. Great defense, check. That's the bingo card. Quinn Ewers making a bad throw and a bad interception, check. And if you do that against Ohio State from that performance that we saw yesterday against Oregon, that's going to kill you. That is going to come back and bite you. But that's exactly what we're going to get into coming up next. Rose Bowl, Ohio State, Oregon. I was not expecting that. I was expecting a one-point game like we saw in the regular season. I was expecting overtime. I was expecting the closest game that we've seen in the college football playoff in the Rose Bowl. And what we got was yet another Ohio State, or yet another college football playoff, rather, blowout. Yet another Ohio State blowout. And Adam, I asked myself going into this Ohio State-Oregon game, is Ohio State who they were against Michigan, or is Ohio State who they were against Tennessee? And all it took really was a quarter for me to be able to answer that question and to answer that question comfortably. And Ohio State is the team that we saw against Tennessee. Ohio State is playing like the team that we expected them to play all season long with the amount of talent they have in that roster.
Yeah. Two words, physical domination. That's what this game was. Chip Kelly and Ryan Day sat down in the 3 weeks they had between the Michigan loss and the Tennessee game, and they had a chance to revisit what they do, who they are on offense, and most importantly, who they get the ball to with 12 games of tape. And they completely changed that around. Jeremiah Smith against Michigan, 5 catches, 35 yards and a touchdown. Jeremiah Smith against Tennessee and Oregon, 13 for 290 yards and 4 touchdowns. That's the difference in this game. And for all the talk about Ohio State's offensive line, 23 different O-line combinations. This is an O-line that has not played well all season long. Boy, did they punch Oregon in the mouth and go up 34-0, rolling the number one seed who was 13-0. It was a physical, dominating performance by Ohio State. And, it's amazing what happens then when you're able to run the football and you get the ball to your 6'4 All-American receiver who's Julio Jones 2.0. I mean, Smith is such a special player. 2 more years of this guy in college football is remarkable. I mean, he is different. He's strong, unbelievable frame. He's a great route runner for his size. He's great at the catch point. He's still a burner and can run by people. He's a generational player. Very few big body receivers can take a slide route 45 yards and roll past Oregon's defense. Very few guys can do that. Potentially would be the first pick in this year's NFL draft, worth every bit of the $5 million he's getting paid. So this is the kind of player that can lead you to a national title. It feels like Ohio State's clicking on offense at the right time. And listen, if Ohio State, if the last two games are what Ryan Day and Chip Kelly put together, then Ohio State's going to win the first 12-team playoff if they play like they did against Oregon.
Look, I think part of what you just said there, 23 different offensive line combinations, doesn't really matter because they finally found one combo that works. And they had to make some shifts. They got some guys back healthy. Things changed. They came into the playoffs. And now all of a sudden, a part of this is that the offensive line is punching. I mean, that Tennessee defensive line was supposed to be a big matchup for them. Wasn't. All right. So now they get into this one. It's like, well, Oregon. And I sat here thinking, man, Oregon got run on so much in the Big Ten championship game. It's going to be a big part of their plan. Instead, they come out right away, just prove, hey, you can't cover our guys. And look, we've all talked about those weapons are uncoverable most of the time. I just haven't seen Will Howard be as efficient getting the ball to him as he is. Like, this is a different version. Will Howard gets a little bit of time, and all of a sudden, whoo! I mean, we got to change the conversation around the way he's throwing the football, because he has the time to make the reads, and all of a sudden you just see, my God, if he gets 3-4 seconds to throw a football, what are you supposed to do about that? You can't cover these guys for that long. So I think this is – Ohio State now is the best of what Ohio State could be. And that's a statement win. I don't get – and we posted a video from Yahoo where Caroline and I were talking about it. And I said, you know, why do we keep underselling Oregon? All they've done is give up yards and points, but they've won every game. And I've got Ohio State fans in there constantly now tagging me, being like, what do you have to say now? Ohio State or Oregon sucks. They just got lucky. Look, Ohio State fans, your narrative here shouldn't be that Oregon sucks. It shouldn't be that Oregon got lucky. Your narrative here is that the number one team in the country that's really stinking good looked so bad because Ohio State played that well. I don't think Oregon suddenly is a bad football team. I think Ohio State right now is playing like a great football team. And there's a difference. Like, don't undersell your opponent. Oversell how good your favorite team is, because Ohio State, man, they've now had their way with two of the best defenses that they're going to see. They look unstoppable.
Ohio State has had the hardest draw. We said it at the very beginning, but it's very true now. They had the hardest draw and the hardest path of any other team in the college football playoff. And they have now had the biggest statements and widest margins of victory than any other team in the college football playoff. And I think that in and of itself speaks volumes of just how dangerous and scary this Ohio State team is. They out-physicaled a team that has been one of the most physical in all of college football. They out-explosive played a team that has had more explosive plays than any other team in college football. I look at what Oregon did to Ohio State in the regular season. It was like 3 or 4 of their first scoring drives were 3 plays, 80 yards, 4 plays, 67-yard touchdown passes. And I look at what Ohio State did yesterday. First drive, 3 plays, 75 yards. Then they punt, they get the ball back, 3 plays, 53 yards, touchdown. Then they had a field goal drive, they get the ball back, touchdown, 2 plays, 48 yards, get the ball back, 1 play, 66 yards to the house. Like, that is efficiency, and that is trusting your playmakers and Amika Egbuka and Jeremiah Smith, which, I mean, best duo in college football by a wide margin. That is scary, especially against an Oregon defense, an Oregon pass defense that has been so good all season long, Adam.
Yeah, and Ohio State put on a clinic schematically as well in this game. It was a mix of the talent Ohio State has, but Oregon has just as much talent. It matches up pretty well. But this was a schematic clinic by Chip Kelly. From a personnel standpoint, from an alignment standpoint, it was a formational masterclass. They had their best players, Jeremiah Smith, Egbuka, going across the formation. They put Jeremiah Smith at X receiver out wide 1-on-1. They put him at number 3 receiver in the 3-by-1 trips formations. They had him all over the place. They had him in the backfield at times, using Jeremiah Smith on the slide routes across the line of scrimmage where you normally see a tight end get into the flat. But using Smith in that spot, it was a great job of Chip Kelly by scheming up ways to get Jeremiah Smith in your best players, touches in open space. And then using that to take the shots down the field. And it set up some attention on Jeremiah Smith to then get Emeka Egbuka the ball and get him involved. So I thought the way Chip Kelly used his players all over the field from an alignment and formation standpoint was great. Also, Ohio State used multiple pass protections in this game to give Will Howard time to throw the football. They utilized movement, rolled Will Howard out of the pocket, used half roll, you know, where you kind of roll him out for 3 yards, then he stands in the pocket, helps your offensive line to get on the move a little bit, to not have him just sit there like a lame duck having to pass that against the defensive line like Oregon has. So using that half roll, the movement for Will Howard really gave him time to take shots down the field, and the run game complemented all of it. The run game complemented that passing game and the protections that Ohio State used. I think my final thought is that, to your point, Fitz, Will Howard is a certified dog. There is no more questions. Will Howard is an elite quarterback. The biggest thing is he is in control. He is calm. He is cool. He is collected. And I love the shot of Will Howard pumping up the crowd to end the third quarter up by 26. I mean, it was cool to see Will Howard in a 26-point blowout, still fired up, getting his guys going, getting the crowd going, always felt in control of this game. And just because guys are at school for 1 to 2 years and are getting paid doesn't mean they can't still love the school they go to. Will Howard loves Ohio State. And I think that was very clear in this game. And at the end of the game and when he was firing up the crowd, that's not lost in all this. But Will Howard, for all we've talked about his ups and downs, man, he played his very best in the biggest game of the year.
So I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't care about conspiracy theories. They don't change my Tuesday. I don't really care, right? I don't care about
where this is going.
I don't care about drones. I don't care about any of that. Like, it's just miss me with all of it. Let me ask you this though, Adam, because what you just described is the best of Chip Kelly. And I think we can make a fair case here that what we saw against Michigan was maybe the worst of Chip Kelly, like a very conservative game plan all the way across the board that made no sense to anybody. For a team that already knew they were in the college football playoff, is there some level of, like, all I keep thinking when I see Ohio State play this well is, were they holding stuff back against Michigan? They're like, we're going to make the playoff anyway. If we win this way, great. If we lose, we don't have to go to the Big Ten championship game. We'll just, because where were this bag of tricks? Michigan never would have been able to stop this bag of tricks. We just didn't see it.
I don't think they were holding anything back. I do think that Chip Kelly and Ryan Day miscalculated their game plan. And I think that they, going into the Michigan game, cared a little bit less about, you know, let's go get our playmakers the ball, and they may focus more on, because of the rivalry probably, we want to physically dominate Michigan off the line of scrimmage and run the football and show them that we're more physical, more powerful, and they weren't, and their offensive line got manhandled. I think that's the big difference. I don't think you hold anything back against Michigan in a game like that.
And it is fair. I will say, I got a text from a buddy that's an Ohio State fanatic last night after the game, and he's like, yeah, I guess. I mean, we'll see. It doesn't really make up for Michigan, but at least we're advancing. Like, I don't, like, Ohio State fans, hear me loud on this. Like, number one, stop downplaying your opponents. I've already said that. Like, let's acknowledge that you beat the best team in the country. Make that team great, so instead of them sucking, you get more credit. But number two, and this is important, they don't raise a banner for beating Michigan. All right? They don't. Sports Illustrated isn't going to say, buy all of our magazines that have you on the cover for beating Michigan. They don't make some sort of memorabilia you buy for your house that says, National We Beat Michigan team on it. Yeah. Like, they don't. All of these, they raise banners for national champions. In the modern construct of what college football is, losing to Michigan is irrelevant if you win the national championship. I don't care. I just don't care if you lose to Michigan every single, like, guess what? Lose to Michigan, win the Natty. Lose to Michigan. If for the next 10 years straight, Ryan Day loses every game to Michigan, but wins 10 straight national championships, is anyone going to sit there and say he should get fired? If they do, they're stupid. And the last thing I would remind Ohio State fans is, if you were at a party and you saw an Alabama fan that just won the national championship being trash-talked by an Auburn fan that won the Iron Bowl that year, you would laugh at them. You'd be like, you know what doesn't matter? The Iron Bowl. You know what does matter? National championships. You know what doesn't matter? The game. What does matter is national championships.
I think you are grossly underestimating that rivalry, because what you're saying is completely correct and totally logical. Only national championships matter, and having trophies and having rings on your fingers, and those are things that you can sell to recruits, and that is how you build a championship program. That's how you build a dynasty. The championships are the only thing that matters. Every coach in America will tell you that's why we do what we do, is to, of course, you know, shape and mold young men. We love football. No, okay, that's all great. Winning championships is the reason why coaches do what they do. But also, beating Michigan is important. Like, also, beating Michigan is the national championship. That I can hear Michigan fans saying, well, that's great that you won the national championship. Can't beat us. Best team in the country, but you can't beat us. And you know what the narrative's going to be next time Ohio State and Michigan play next season in the game? It's going to be, well, Michigan's won the last four straight. That's what it's going to be. And that's how important that game is. So I'm with you. National championships are the only thing that matters. But to those fan bases, that game matters. I'm not going to say just as much, but it's 1B. Maybe it's more. Maybe it is more.
I think the problem is it's more. I think there's plenty of fans out there for Ohio State that would trade this run they're going on for a win over Michigan. And that, like, I understand it. I just think it's asinine. If we see something stupid, say something about it. Like, this is stupid to me. Like, I get the passion for it, but it's antiquated knowledge, because it's antiquated thinking, because a generation ago, your grandfather's Ohio State had to beat Michigan because back then they voted on a national champion. Like, the world was so different then. You had to beat Michigan because you couldn't control any of the other variables. Like, in 2 or 3 years, when they're talking about Ryan Day, it's not just going to be its record against Michigan. That'll be one note. The next note will be his record in the playoffs. And guess what? Right now, he's 2-0 in the playoffs with a margin of victory that's absolutely stunning, right? In the expanded playoff, it's going to be what's your record in the playoffs, what's your record in national championship games. Those are going to be 1 and 1A. And then what's your record against your rival is going to become the way down here. That's going to be the next variable in my mind.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. I want to add one more point here to put a bow on Ohio State, Oregon. Don't let it go unnoticed how good Ohio State's defense was in this game with all the talk about their offense. I mean, this is the silver bullet for Ohio State of old. 8 sacks, 3 players with 2 sacks each. Jack Sawyer, JTT, Cody Simon, 2 sacks. I mean, in October, Ohio State let up, 500 yards to Oregon? Yesterday, they let up 200-some yards to Oregon, including minus 23 rushing yards, including Dillon Gabriel getting sacked 8 times. I mean, it wasn't just the offense. It was a defensive masterclass as well for Ohio State, and they clearly look like the best team in the country right now. I would imagine that they are the odds-on favorite by far right now. I didn't check the odds after the game to win the national championship.
What's the one thing that we've been talking about? I guess two things. Crazy. Insane. But the two things that we've been talking so much about throughout this entire playoff structure is the team that can run the ball the best and the team that can most effectively and efficiently stop the run. Ohio State can run the football. We know that. They got 180 rushing yards and almost 6 yards a crack. And they didn't even really need to run the football. But whenever you've got a two-headed monster in Jeremiah Smith and Emeka Egbuka that opens so much of what you can do in the run game, and then you've got Travion Henderson and Quinshon Judkins there ready to carry the load. So they can run the football incredibly effectively. And what we saw yesterday, I think, was maybe the most terrifying thing that we've seen all playoff long. And that is hold Oregon to minus 26 rushing yards, 23 rushing yards, excuse me. Of course, that's sack adjusted, but still, Ohio State completely took the run away. So if we want to say that the national champion is the team that best runs the football and most effectively stops the run, well, that's Ohio State, and that's Ohio State by a wide margin, a wide margin. So Ohio State right now looks like the most terrifying team in the country. We'll wrap up Ohio State, Oregon, ahead to Power Hour and Power Outage coming up next. Okay, Adam, Power Hour, Power House. Who does it go to for you?
I'm going with Cam Scadaboo's NFL stock. I mean, this is an NFL player. Everyone was bashing Cam for talking shit before the game, saying he's the best running back in the country. Everyone was saying he was too cocky. But some guys just thrive on that a little bit. Some guys need that extra edge, and Cam Scadaboo certainly does. And that's what happened. I mean, 140-some rushing yards, 2 touchdowns on the ground, 8 catches, 100 yards receiving, and a 50-yard passing touchdown. Unreal. The trifecta for him on offense. I mean, it was unbelievable to watch. And Cam is a Christian McCaffrey in the NFL. He's a running back who can play every down, who catches 6 to 7 passes a game, can pass protect, and can run between the tackles and out in the perimeter. And he's not just a bruiser. He is slippery. I had this this perception of him that he was a bruiser between the tackles, kind of, you know, he's a good college player, won't play in the NFL. I was wrong. He is a real NFL type of player. And I think his story is kind of one of being overlooked at a high school. That's why he went to Sac State. But once he got in a real weight room, a real nutrition program, he became a top NFL draft pick. And I think he's a day 2 NFL guy, and he proved it in this game. He's not just a bruiser. He's not just a fullback. He's not an H-back. He is an every down NFL running back.
Yeah, and I'll stack onto that because we're talking Power Hour. I want to give a little bit more love. I know lost, like Arizona State lost, and we're giving a lot of love to Arizona State on this show. But I thought Dillingham, and that game plan in the second half and the lack of quit in those guys, when this thing was 17-3, you got to fight your way out of the corner. And not every team can fight their way out of the corner. I thought the halfback pass, like the trick play, was brilliantly called at a perfect time. It just, there was a pace and an energy. And as the game went on, man, it felt like that entire team took on the identity of their coach. And there was a little bit of a, like a Hulk Hogan in the 80s, like working, shaking their way, the whole crowd going with them. Like, I don't know, that was something special to see. And it feels like, you never know, but this just feels like the beginning of an era for Arizona State. Feels like something really special is about to happen there. And a lot of it has to be on Dillingham's shoulder. So I think he deserves another tip of the cap when we talk about Power Hour.
Totally. That's my powerhouse is you say Cam Scadaboo, NFL draft stock. Totally fair because he is, you know, otherworldly. And he's also a terrifying human being when he just stands there on the sidelines with his arms wide open. And he's staring down the camera after he makes a big play. Like Cam Scadaboo is awesome. But my Power Hour powerhouse is Arizona State stock. That Arizona State probably played the biggest game in their program in the last 25 to 30 years, fair to say. And Arizona State came out obviously slow, but came out like that, had a showing like that against a team like Texas, where really in on so many areas of the game and so many areas on paper, Texas is just the better team, the more physical team, the stronger team overall, the better team. And Arizona State took them to two overtimes. You have a quarterback that I don't know what the 2025 way too early Heisman odds are right now, but I think after yesterday, Sam Leavitt should be top five. You've got a young quarterback that you trust, a dynamic young quarterback. You have a coach that is an expert motivator and a guy that Arizona State, very rightfully so, believes in very much, and especially a coach, too, that believes very much so in Arizona State. Kenny Dillingham is from Phoenix, Arizona. Kenny Dillingham grew up an Arizona State coach. Kenny Dillingham has talked about how Arizona State has always been his dream job, whereas maybe a lot of other coaches in college football would view Arizona State as a springboard kind of opportunity. Kenny Dillingham adores that university. So I think everything that it has going for it, all the momentum, all the attention that it has, and the way that I feel like America has kind of fallen in love with the Arizona State football program, I'll buy stock into what Arizona State can become and continue to build on over the next 5 to 10 years. Arizona State's a blast to watch. But Fitz, it's not all sunshine and roses. We've got a Power Hour power outage. Who was it for you?
Yeah, the power outage is special teams from underdogs. I just, like, look, we talked about Arizona State with, you know, missed kick, and we talked about Arizona State with the punt return touchdown, but Boise State also fell victim to this. Like, you have to play power, you have to be really good on special teams in these situations to win these games when you're the underdog. And if you're not, you won't. Both of these teams are going to look back for that throughout the course of the year, through offseason, and say, what might have been if we had just been a little bit cleaner on special teams. And that, you know, special teams, in some ways, it looks at your depth. In some ways, it's an opportunity. But frankly, you cannot lose the special teams battle when you are an underdog playing a team that's bigger, faster, stronger. And both of the teams in Boise State and Arizona State that needed a clean special teams performance didn't get it. So a power outage there. Hate picking on kickers, but I feel like that's all I'm doing right now is picking on kickers. Kickers and kick coverage, Brendan.
How about power outage, Phil Knight's NIL money?
Well played, sir. Well played.
No, I mean, honestly, Ohio State did the same thing, kind of. Ohio State's defense wasn't paid and bought for defense. Their offense is. But I think that game was more about Ohio State dominating than it was about Oregon not being very good. But I just think Phil Knight can't be happy with all the money he spent on this roster to lose their first-round playoff game, which brings me into my second power outage, which is probably just the playoff structure. It frustrates me that Oregon's first game was as an underdog to Ohio State. Shouldn't be that way. But listen, you got to play the cards you're dealt, and Oregon did not play them very well.
And it's a very, very fair point. And it's the same thing I think we would have said if Ohio State got their booties handed to them like they did to Oregon, is a power outage to all of the NIL money that they pumped into this team. It's very clear. Like they pushed all the coins in the middle. And this is a carefully curated and carefully paid for team designed to win a national championship. And to that point, too, I'll say power outage to first round buys. Because obviously Notre Dame and Georgia has yet to be played. That's one important data point that we have yet to be solved. But is it the bye that was the rust factor, or was it just you have Boise State and Arizona State, two teams that were outmatched in their first game of the college football playoff, and then an Ohio State team that's playing hotter than any other team in college football? Like, maybe that's more so the case in the truth than it is the bye. But teams that had the bye did not look very good, did not perform very well. And in Arizona State's case, did not perform very well in the first half. So that's going to be interesting moving forward as we continue to you know, figure out the kinks in this college football playoff structure is the bye really that valuable, or was the bye just given to teams that weren't really going to be all that competitive in the playoff anyways? So power outage to a first round bye. That's going to do it for us today. We'll be back tomorrow with a full reaction to the Sugar Bowl, Georgia, Notre Dame. So everyone in New Orleans for that game, be very safe, be very careful. I know it's a very scary time in a city that I adore and love very much. So sending all of our thoughts out to everyone in New Orleans. He's Adam Brenneman. You can follow him on Twitter at AdamBrenneman81. He's at Jason Fitz. You can find me at CarolineFenton1. Always appreciate y'all for stopping by the podcast. So give it a like, give it a subscribe, give it a review, give it a comment. Appreciate y'all for interacting with the podcast. Again, we'll be back tomorrow morning with a full Sugar Bowl recap. We're out.